Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
The philosophy of John Locke.
Locke was the favorite philosopher of our founding fathers.
He influenced the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Locke argued against the divine right of kings.
He believed in government by consent of the governed.
To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Our guest is Bill Yiegelis, author of A Reader's Guide to Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding.
He will actually channel John Locke so we can talk to him directly.
I made the mistake of failing to introduce myself. My name is John Locke.
The Philosophy of John Locke. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the 17th century British philosopher John Locke.
Ken, in America, John Locke is probably best known as one of the inspirations for our founding fathers. His book, Two Treatises of Government, argues against the divine right of kings and in favor of government by consent of the governed. His views were admired greatly by Thomas Jefferson and also by others of our founding fathers.
Not only was he an influential philosopher, he was a very politically active philosopher as well, John.
He lived in the last half of the 17th century, which in England were very exciting times.
Right. Charles I was beheaded. The monarchy was overthrown. Oliver Cromwell governed for a while. That was followed by two more Stuarts, Charles II and James II, as the monarchy came back. And then William came from the Netherlands, married James's second cousin Mary, and William and Mary took over as constitutional monarchs without any divine right to rule. That was called the Glorious Revolution.
Now, according to the legend I was taught, maybe it's an urban legend, but Locke really wrote his two treatises in part to justify these revolutions in England.
But you know, John, even independent of his political philosophy, we got to say that John Locke would still be counted as one of the great philosophers in Western history. I mean, his book, Essay Concerning Human Understanding, is one of the most important books in the history of philosophy. He more or less invented the philosophical subject of personal identity, more or less invented the topic of philosophy of language. You are my favorite topic.
And you know, Ken, we have a rare treat today. We're not only going to talk about John Locke, we're going to talk with John Locke himself.
That's right. Even though the real John Locke died a couple of hundred years ago, we'll be conducting an interesting experiment today.
Our guest is the very prominent Locke scholar Bill Yiegelis. And he will be channeling John Locke. It's a technique they've developed at his Oregon State Philosophy Department with the help of computer science and astrophysics and some other departments.
Yeah. So, you know, since we're going to have Locke himself here, I think I'm going to ask him about his views on slavery. It's kind of amazing to me that the founding fathers like Jefferson could write so clearly, inspired by Locke, so clearly about the rights of all humans, natural rights of all humans, and human inequality, and then turn around and own slaves. But, you know, Locke himself had some rather weird things to say about slavery, so I want to know if he approved of it or disapproved of it.
Well, I want to ask a similar question about women. There are some glimmers of rights for women in Locke, but what did he really think?
And I'm also interested in finding out the extent of his involvement in the overthrow of Charles I and what his role was in replacing James II with William and Mary. I've read somewhere that he actually justified the assassination of kings. Was he an assassin?
I don't know. I mean, we're going to find out. I guess what I really want to know is, was he that rarest of all birds, a politically effective philosopher?
These are important questions, John. So we'll have to use our limited time with John Locke wisely before he goes back into the grave. But before we talk to either of our guests, Mr. Yiegelis or Mr. Locke, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, also went in search of the real John Locke. She files this report.
There are hundreds of John Locke's in the phone book.
My name is John Locke. I live in Saratoga, California.
John Robert Locke.
My name is John Locke.
Who I'm named after? I don't know. I would guess an uncle. Nobody ever told me.
I am the great, 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 great grandson of the philosopher John Locke. No, I'm just kidding.
But of course, we're talking about the John Locke, the man whose theories in education became a kind of guide for parents and teachers for hundreds of years. The man who publicly criticized slavery when it was unfashionable to do so. The man who spent half a decade in exile for his ideas.
John Locke was one of the two greatest English minds of the late 17th century, or maybe three if you want to throw in Thomas Hobbes along with Sir Isaac Newton.
Jack Rakove is a professor at Stanford. He teaches history, political science, and American studies. And he has a shelf in his office devoted entirely to biographies of John Locke.
Yeah, Locke has a kind of bony face. He's got, you know, his hair is worn, as was fashionable in the 17th century. His hair is a bit on the lanky, somewhat, you know, strewn side. He does, you know, certainly conveys, you know, a look of intellectual engagement, not a study in high court fashion. But you look at him and I'd like to think you see an active mind.
John Locke was born in 1632, a tumultuous time in British history. There were conflicts between the monarchy and parliament, conflicts between Protestants, Catholics, and Anglicans, and Locke was born into a radical household. That is, his father was a radical Calvinist.
You can see Locke wrestling with a whole variety of positions on a whole array of issues. For starters, one could say Locke's Christianity.
Locke later became a Unitarian. He attended Oxford, where hallway conversations were actually in Latin. He studied logic, metaphysics, and medicine. He falls in with a crowd of men who criticize the monarchy and question absolutism.
So Locke is flirting with resistance, potentially revolutionary ideas, which were quite radical.
Fast forward to the 1680s. Locke gets involved with some armed revolutionaries plotting to kill King Charles II.
Locke appears to have gotten involved in the Rye House plot, which would have been a virtual coup d'etat. Against the Stuart kings, and then when that plot collapses, he wisely thought it was a good idea to absent himself to Holland, where he lives in political exile for, you know, 5 or 6 years until he goes back to England after the Glorious Revolution has taken place.
In 1688, William and Mary take the throne. Locke actually returns to England on the same boat that reunites Mary with her husband. With all his plotting and moving around, Locke stayed a bachelor his entire life.
Locke never married, though he seems to fall in love at a couple points, but he was single all his life. At one point he was in love with the daughter of a prominent Neoplatonist.
That woman's name was Damaris Cudworth, a philosopher in her own right. She and Locke exchanged love letters under the pseudonyms Philoclea and Philander. But then Cudworth married someone else. She and her former flame remained friends. Locke became her permanent house guest. He actually died in her house in 1704. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Bill Ugalis. He's a professor of philosophy from Oregon State University. He's author of Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding, A Reader's Guide. Bill, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, Ken.
So, Bill, tell us how you got interested in this fellow, John Locke.
Well, I read the Second Treatise of Government at Stanford when I was a TA for Gerasimo Santos, and really thought it was a wonderful book. After that, I got interested in problems of personal identity, and that led me to write my dissertation about Locke.
I remember that.
Yeah, you were my dissertation advisor.
So now recently you've published a book on John Locke, a guide to his essay concerning human understanding. Is anybody really interested in what this guy wrote 300 years ago about a subject we have learned so much about since then?
Well, I think the answer to that continues to be yes. And the reason is that Locke represents a particularly interesting form of scientific empiricism that the later British empiricists to some degree abandoned. And it shows the difficulties with empiricism. There are a whole host of interesting issues in the essay, you know, apart from that general theme of empiricism. And I think one of them that will connect with our discussion of Locke's political philosophy is that he is essentially an anti-authoritarian. He really wants people to engage in inquiry and use their minds in order to find the truth. And he really thinks that that's of fundamental importance to humankind.
So it's really important that not to take things on just received authority or the authority of the church, the authority of tradition, just to think for yourself, right? I mean, but let me ask you another question about that. I know that we're going to mainly talk about his political philosophy, although we'll have to get into his broader metaphysical and epistemological philosophy too. But is Locke still relevant to political thinking today? I mean, why are we talking about this long-dead 17th-century guy whom we're going to channel in a little bit? Is he still relevant, and why?
Well, I think one of the things that Locke does is he makes a real effort to try and distinguish the function of government. And whether you think answer to what the proper function of government is correct or not, it's still a wonderful starting place for inquiry. Locke was a revolutionary, so he was trying to distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate functioning governments. And given the issue of revolution is so important these days, that answer still resonates, I would think.
So do you think that if I were to take Locke's Second Treatise on Government over to Egypt or Tunisia or Libya and have people on the barricades read it, could they learn anything from that about how to think about founding a new state? Because obviously much of the world is in turmoil even as we speak. Could Locke help people think through that turmoil?
Well, it's a little hard to say how this would work in an Islamic culture, but I guess I would think the answer would be yes, because when you have some clear idea of what it is you want government to do, surely it would be easier to do it. And that's really what Locke provides in a way.
So, Bill, when you return, you're going to be channeling John Locke. I have some questions about that. I'll just recite them all. You can answer the ones you want. First, I'd like to know how it works metaphysically and technologically, but I realize this is a patented process, no doubt, so you might not be able to disclose all of the metaphysical details. But on a more practical level, when you channel him, do you sound like John Locke? I'm not sure I could understand a 17th century British accent. Or in the channeling process, is it somehow converted to good old Willamette Valley English?
Well, I'm afraid that given the fact that I have a cold today, the accent isn't going to come through as well as it might otherwise. You may hear a hint of it.
But are you a practice channeler? When did you start channeling Locke? Are you a practice channeler of Locke?
This was a recently developed technique, and so far we've only used it on Locke. We've tried to contact Kant, but we're having troubles.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to the man himself. I'm going to tell you, since I have lots of questions for Locke, I'm going to be kind of aggressive with Mr. Locke, maybe more than I would be with Mr. Yugalis, but just be prepared. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing the philosopher John Locke with Bill Yugalis from Oregon State University.
Bill is not only an expert on Locke's philosophy, he's an expert channeler of John Locke, the man. At least he's the best channeler of John Locke, the man I know of. In our next segment, we'll ask the great 17th century philosopher himself to put his own philosophical ideas under our modern microscope.
John Locke's first ever live radio appearance from the grave, plus your calls and emails. When Philosophy Talk continues.
When America's founding fathers decided they wanted a revolution, they were not inspired by the songs of John Lennon. They were inspired by the writings of John Locke. I'm not John Lennon or John Locke. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. I'm not a John at all. This is Philosophy Talk. Today we have a rare chance to talk directly to a great dead philosopher. Has representative democracy turned out as well as Locke hoped? We can ask the man himself in a moment.
Our guest, Bill Ugalis from Oregon State University, has spent the past few minutes connecting to the spirit of John Locke. And I think he's ready to begin channeling him now. So we're thrilled to welcome the great British philosopher himself to the program. John Locke, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, Ken. Hello, John. Splendid to hear from you.
Mr. Locke, or may I call you John Locke, sir, or Sir Locke? What should I call you?
John Locke is fine.
Okay, so John Locke, if I may, you'll be happy to know, I think you'll be thrilled to know, that your second treatise on government, Your Defense of Government by Consent of the Governed, is still required reading in colleges and universities around the world. It's probably been through its 200th printing or something. But now, your first treatise, well, you know, it was widely read in its day. It's not so widely read now. Your first treatise, you criticize the divine right of kings. I wonder something. Did people ever really believe in the divine right of kings? I mean, was that something people seriously believed? And if they did, what led you to disbelieve it, to challenge it?
Well, Ken, when I wrote the two treatises, they were companion pieces. And both of them were aimed at the writings of Sir Robert Filmer. And Sir Robert was indeed defending the divine right of kings. And in effect, what he argued was that people are naturally slaves of their rulers. And when I wrote, Sir Robert had already died, but his book was being reprinted and shouted from the pulpit. So did the Stuart monarchy actually believe they had a divine right and that divine right made people slaves? The answer is indeed yes.
Did ordinary people believe that they were naturally subject to their kings, that they were naturally subject to the monarchy and that their rights were only what the monarch said they had?
No, indeed. And Englishmen have always loved their freedom. And this was precisely the point at which the country party's rhetoric played on the difference between the people and the kings. We told them that the kings were going to make them slaves, and they voted for us in droves.
So we want to get into your ideas pretty deeply, but I just can't help asking. I mean, the statute of limitations is presumably taken care of any problems you might have. Were you really involved in the Rye House plot? Did you really favor killing kings?
Well, you know, there are some things about which your historians are still puzzling, and I'm afraid I can't reveal the answers to those things.
you want to leave the historians to be able to do their work, eh?
Yes, but I will say this, that, you know, I think if you read the Second Treatise of Government, it will leave little doubt in your mind as to the answer to that question.
Okay.
So look, the kings believed, or at least said they believed, that they ruled with divine right. And did the church, where was the church on these issues? Did the church believe that kings ruled with divine right? Or were they on the side of the people who thought that the monarchs had to be limited?
Well, you have to remember that England was a theocracy. And the Anglican church was a state church. So you can pretty well guess what side the pulpit was on. One might say, there was a struggle for the heart of the Anglican Church, and the royalty were strongly pro-Catholic. Charles II made a secret treaty at Dover in which he, for a large sum of money, told Louis XIV that he would try to make England Catholic.
Mr. Locke, I'm going to be cynical here. Okay, so here's a cynical thought for you. So here one set of elites, the royalty, the nobility, and the ecclesiastical authority, are on the side of the divine right of kings. And you said the people didn't go along with that. Here's what I'm going to suggest to you. It was a rising mercantile class, because I know you were big on property and big on private property. It was the rising capitalist elite who said, hey, wait a minute. right? If we don't overthrow these kings, we can't have our way. So the ordinary people, the hoi polloi, they probably were just, you know, in betwixt and between. But it was rich guys like you and your capitalist wannabes that thought the kings didn't have the divine right. So it was a competition between competing elites. What do you think about that, Mr. Locke?
Well, Ken, it's certainly true that the mercantile class were suffering from taxes imposed by the king in order to escape from parliamentary control of his finances. Indeed, this is why he made that awful treaty with Louis XIV. But given who could vote, the answer to your question is they came out in droves and voted for the Country Party so that the lower house of parliament was filled with our supporters. And again, we managed to pass an exclusion bill to keep James, the Duke of York, from becoming king. That bill was killed every time in the upper house.
So if we can get away for a minute from not-so-current events and talk about ideas. Now, in your second treatise, your basic picture is that there was this state of nature, right, before we had governments. And then the people in the state of nature, kind of to take care of the bullies, kind of had a convention and decided to institute a government. That's the way it goes. Now, did you really believe that happened, or is this... was this idea of a social contract, I guess that's Rousseau's phrase, but was this idea of a social contract and a government that serves with the consent of the government, was this really a historical hypothesis or just sort of a metaphor?
Well, you need to recall that the purpose of the Second Treatise was to provide a new founding of government in which might does not make right. And the trouble with the state of nature, whether it existed or not, and certainly in the relation between states it exists, even today, the purpose of all of this was to provide a foundation for government which would protect the rights of people to life, liberty, health, and property. Now, do I believe that such a state existed? Well, in many ways, many states came about through conquest, historically. But is that how they should have come about or how it would have made them legitimate? I don't think so.
So, Mr. Locke, let me ask you to distinguish two things. But before I do that, I'm going to remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Bill Ugalis, who's channeling John Locke about John Locke's political philosophy. So, look, I want you to distinguish two things. So your book asks, well, men in the state of nature, there's no government between them. And I think, where did human beings ever exist such that there was no government between them? How could that be? Maybe way back in the caveman days. But every human being today is born in a political society with a government already intact. And his consent is never really asked what he's going to do, right? But then I think, well, maybe you don't mean that as a historical hypothesis. Maybe you mean us to perform a thought experiment. Imagine human beings in the state of nature without any government between them. What kind of government would they found and why? Should we think of it as a legitimizing thing or a historical descriptive thing?
Well, Ken, you know, if you read the chapter of property carefully, what I do is I take you through an evolution of the state of nature from hunting-gathering to agricultural to the advent of money. And what these represented, if you want to take this as a thought experiment, is the different stages of the development of humankind towards the advent of government. And part of the way in which my state of nature differs from Hobbes is that Hobbes starts out the state of nature with a large population and few resources, and consequently everyone is immediately at war with one another to try and get what they can. In my state of nature, you start out with many resources and few people, and slowly develop towards that state where there are more people and fewer resources. And it's at that point that the social contract
I see. Now, Mr. Hobbs, one of your great intellectual competitors, I guess. I don't know how you describe the relationship between you and Mr. Hobbs. Mr. Hobbs thought that he described the state of life in the state of nature as nasty, brutish, and short. Because it was a war of all against all, where everybody had a right to everything.
I always thought that was nasty, British, and short.
Yeah, right.
Did I have that wrong?
Yes, nasty, British, and short. You think life in the state of nature, it sounds like you think it's pretty cool, and rights are more limited than he thinks, because he thinks nobody really has rights, because everybody has a right to anything. You think the state of nature is more harmonious and peaceful?
Well, on my view, the state of nature has a law of nature to it. And the law of nature is, in effect, the golden rule read through a theory of natural rights. That is, as I don't want my rights to life, liberty, health, and property to be violated, so I will not violate the rights to life, liberty, and property of others.
So I like the second treatise. I've taught it a lot. I admire you greatly. But how about women? Where do they come in? I mean, the whole thing is sort of paternalistic and male-oriented, isn't it? Have you followed development since you died? You know that women have really kind of come alive in the last half of the 20th and the first part of the 21st century and are, you know, taking over a lot of power and demanding equal rights. What do you think of all that?
I think it is splendid. You do have to remember that my friend Damaris Cudworth was one of what are now looked back on as one of the great 17th century feminists. I was writing against Sir Robert Filmer, who wrote a book called Patriarcha. And I did, I must say, have a good number of intellectual women friends. Now, the society in which I was living was quite patriarchal, it's true. And in writing a revolutionary treatise, one has to limit the battles one is fighting. Had I wanted to put off all the people that we were trying to influence with the second treatise, I might have gone further.
So, Mr. Locke, you're telling us that you were at heart a compromiser and not just a radical revolutionary, but you know what? I'm going to let some callers have at you, Mr. Locke. Joel in San Bruno's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joel.
Hey, thanks for having me. Mr. Locke, I was curious. We've talked a lot about who you have influenced, but I want to know who your influences were. Like, who were you getting your ideas from?
Well, that depends on what subject in particular you're interested in. I have an extraordinarily broad number of interests. In science, I was interested, I was influenced by Robert Boyle and Sir Isaac Newton, by Galileo, by Descartes. In philosophy, I was influenced by Descartes, although I didn't agree with his rationalism. You know, I spent about 20 years reflecting as I was writing my essay concerning human understanding, and there were an enormous number of influences.
Well, thank you for that call, Joel, and for that information, Mr. Locke. I'm going to press you a little bit. Sounds like the state of nature, by your lights, is a pretty cool thing. I mean, we're governed by the golden rule. You know, there's enough to go around. Why would we ever need a government? I mean, Hobbes said we need a government because in the state of nature, life is nasty, brutish, and short, and we're all in danger from each other, and everybody has a right to everything and to limit their rights and to, you know, make peace among us. We need a government. But it sounds like the state of nature is kind of idyllic in your view. So why do we ever need a government at all?
An excellent question, Ken. And here's the answer. What happens when someone violates the law of nature? Well, the answer is there's no police, there's no government to help you, there's no judiciary to carry out a trial, so you have to do it all yourself. And as the state of nature evolves in the way I described earlier, those problems become more and more pressing. It becomes a bit more like Mr. Hobbes' state of nature. And so one needs government. The difference between Mr. Hobbes and I is that I have a reason for the way in which government ought to operate, which is that it now takes over the job of ensuring that people's rights to life, liberty, health, and property are not violated. That is the legitimate function of government.
So there are certain natural rights, right, that can't be fully safeguarded in the state of nature, and the sole purpose of government is to safeguard these natural rights. And you can't, the government has no powers, should have no legitimate powers, except those that are necessary to safeguard these natural rights. Do I have you right?
Not quite. Government has the function of safeguarding those rights. But it also has the power to make all laws with penalties, including death and everything less than that. And it has the power to preserve the people from foreign invasion and all of the necessary means to engage in that activity. And it has to do all of this for the public good.
So we've got an email here on this topic. Do Mr. Locke's views give us a way to decide between competing beliefs as to which are natural laws and natural rights and which are not? That's from somebody named Klefstick. Oh, it's from John in Berkeley.
So I'm going to key that question up for you, Mr. Locke, and you can take it after our break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of John Locke with the great man himself, as channeled through Bill Yugalis from Oregon State University.
Coming up, did Locke approve of slavery? Did he see a role for women in politics? Well, we've already discussed that some. Would he approve of fighting a war over something as trivial as a tax on tea?
Speaking of tea, John Locke's name is often invoked by the Tea Party. What does Locke himself think of Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann, or of Bill Kristol for that matter? We'll find out when Philosophy Talk continues. Talking about a revolution.
We're talking about a revolution. The revolution and revolutions fueled by the writings of John Locke. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is the great 17th century political philosopher John Locke, as channeled by Bill Yugalis from Oregon State University.
Mr. Locke, we've got some emails. I'm going to read all three of them to you or briefly summarize them, and then you can pick and choose what you want to answer. The first is the one I mentioned last time. What's your criterion for what's a natural right and natural law? The second is a bit more provocative from Greg Slater. It says, Mr. Locke, I hope you've had a good look at modern governments during your resurrection or whatever it is that allows you to talk on the telephone. I'm wondering what you think of our variation on your idea. Here in the United States, we have government by consent of the corporate citizens and the fully and hopelessly propagandized human citizens. I assume you are sickened by what you see today. And the third email, you may not be an expert on, but I'll throw it out anyway. It asks to what extent Voltaire, as well as yourself, had an influence on Thomas Jefferson. So there's a bunch of stuff for you to chew on, Mr. Locke. What's your reaction?
Well, I would say that your government is indeed in trouble. When I wrote the second treatise, it wasn't just about politics. It was about economics as well. And certainly the economic system that we were looking at the time, I was very ambivalent about. And it has developed in extraordinary ways that has indeed turned your American Revolution into an oligarchy.
But Mr. Locke, I think that sort of follows from the way you thought about this. Help me think, tell me why I'm wrong. Because you were big, you believe that private property is a pre-political right. That in the state of nature, people can take things out from the common and claim it as their own. And then once money is invented, you can store up excess value, right, on all this stuff. And government is supposed to protect private property, supposed to protect money, moneyed interests. Doesn't it just follow if we implement your kind of principles that we'll get to an oligarchy?
Ken, another really excellent question. And here's the answer to it. If you read the Second Treatise as treating property as fundamental, absolutely fundamental, you would get the result that you just described brilliantly. However, if you look at Chapter 2, Section 6 of the Second Treatise, you will find that I regard rights as a means to an end, and the end is human flourishing. And insofar as those rights become exaggerated and used in such a way that they prevent human flourishing on a large scale, they thereby contradict the law of nature and should be limited. And so, at least the way I was thinking of these things, the economic system wouldn't have developed in the way it did if people had been conscious that they needed to help everyone in the world flourish once their own subsistence wasn't in question anymore.
I understand that, and I see how you're reading your own writings, because you say you can take stuff from the commons and turn it into private property only as long as you leave good enough left for everybody else, right? Only so that you don't diminish what's available to all. But I wonder if you now think you just didn't foresee how run amok a pre-political right of property, which was the foundation of what the government was supposed to do, protect it, how run amok that could become. Did you just not foresee how property could run amok? I mean, you were a great corporatist in a way, because weren't you part of the Carolina Corporation and all that?
I did work for Lord Shaftesbury, who was one of the proprietors of the Carolinas. I was the secretary to the Lord Proprietors of the Carolinas. But, you know, in the pursuit of what the Lord Proprietors were after, we got in a rather sharp conflict with the colonists we sent over. They wanted to grab as much land as possible and to enslave Indians, and we wanted them to bunch together so they could defend themselves and leave the Indians alone. So,
Speaking of enslaving, just to tell you about this. So, you know, you talk about the natural equality in the state of nature of all human beings, and that every person is owned by God and not even owned by himself, and no person can own another person in the state of nature, and government can't own people, right? Because that's what despots try to do, is turn their citizens into property by turning them into slaves. Yet, our founding fathers, who base a lot of what they thought about governance on your writings, many of them were slaveholders, and you have this strange defense of a kind of slavery. What's up with that, dude? What's up with the equality angle in the state of nature, but a defense of slavery?
Well, Ken, one of the things that I was trying to do in the Second Treatise was to distinguish between absolute or despotical power and genuine political power. And so I gave a very minimalist account of absolute power, which is the power of a lord legitimately over his slave. And in that account, basically what I say is that the only people who can be legitimately enslaved are people who try and violate the rights of innocent people, get overthrown in a just war, and instead of being killed by their just conqueror, can be enslaved. That's it.
So in modern day America, the only people we could enslave would be all of these corporate fat cats who've screwed us. I mean, maybe Bernie Madoff could be a slave, but nobody else.
I don't think it goes that way. Somebody who tries to take over your land and in legitimate self-defense, you could either kill them. Slavery is less of a burden on them than death, is what you're saying.
So you're legitimately holding a knife to somebody's throat who's done you a wrong by the natural law, and then you say, well, I won't kill you if you'll be my slave, and that's okay.
That's precisely it.
And I take it you didn't think even then that American slavery fit that definition.
Quite so.
Let me ask you one last question. A lot of people want to claim your mantle these days. We have this Tea Party. I don't know what you thought about the Boston Tea Party way back when, but we have this Tea Party movement, which wants limited government back to the founding fathers. Do you think they've got it? They've got, you know, their conception of limited government matches yours, so they are rightly claiming your mantle?
Well, I think there are two things I would say about the Tea Party. Their enthusiasm for democracy is admirable. What the Tea Party lacks is precisely what I was trying to persuade people through virtually all of my writings, and that is one has to learn to think carefully for oneself and to engage in inquiry to find out the truth about these things. Only the individual can decide that their government is violating their rights. But good heavens, if you get it wrong, the costs are considerable. And so inquiry is enormously important. And that is what the Tea Party lacks. They just simply make it up.
Well, on that note, Mr. Locke, I'm going to thank you for joining on that inspirational note, because inquiry, I know inquiry means philosophical inquiry, inquiry of the rational mind. And so we applaud you for endorsing philosophy talk. And thank you so much for joining us.
You are so welcome.
Our guest has been the British philosopher John Locke, as channeled by the American philosopher Bill Ugalis. Bill is a professor of philosophy at Oregon State University. He's author of Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding, A Reader's Guide. And I want to let people know that we'll be performing three live shows in Oregon from Wednesday, April 13th through Friday, April 15th. For details, go check out our website at philosophytalk.org. So, John, what are your closing thoughts today?
Well, I was really happy to talk to John Locke, and I hope the Oregon State Department can develop its channeling technique so we can channel some other philosophers, you know. I like Locke, but you raised an interesting question early on about how the people in Libya or Egypt should look on this. And I think the problem with our traditional defenses of democracy and rights of the people is that they all have this state of nature, social contract thing, yeah, even John Rawls. But the real question arises not when you're trying to leave the state of nature, but when you're trying to leave the state of tyranny.
Right.
And somebody should have written a handbook on that situation.
Well, in one way, though, that's what Locke intended to do, because he said, look, we don't start out with these guys having legitimate authority over us. Assume we start out with no legitimate authority. Then what would be a legitimate authority? But you know what? We can't dig into that right now. But this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog. Also visit our Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. Now, we'll try to help a listener through a real-life problem using the tools of philosophy. We call it a conundrum.
And we've got a caller on the line now, Connie from Sunnyvale. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Connie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you do down there in Sunnyvale?
I work in media relations.
Sounds like fascinating work. So why don't you tell us about your conundrum?
Okay, so my conundrum sort of relates to the current real estate crisis that our country is in. And a few weeks ago, I was chatting with a real estate agent who's selling a place next door to mine. And it turns out my neighbor bought his condominium for $450,000 about 3 years ago before the crash. And now he has decided to sell it on a short sale at about $240,000. His real estate agent explained to me that he, quote, wanted to get out from under the debt that he incurred. He would take a hit on his credit score for just about a year, and then he was hoping to re-enter the real estate market at the new lower prices. And it sounded to me as though he really wasn't undergoing that much financial hardship, and he just was throwing in the towel and taking a hit on his credit for a year. And I thought that was unethical. I think
if
you have credit card debt, you get bad credit for 7 years if you file for bankruptcy, and most credit card debt doesn't amount to $200,000.
I mean, it used to be that if you couldn't fulfill your financial obligations, you were thrown in debtor's prison. Then bankruptcy came into vogue. It was much more humane. This was a social policy that was, thought to be the best thing for encouraging good things in society. So there was a moral aspect to bankruptcy. Now, the mortgage system in the United States is already a tremendous boon to home ownership. It's unlike anything else in the world, except others that have been an imitation of it. The idea that the thing is set up so that you can borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars, putting down only 10 or 20%, that's unprecedented in the history of the world and still pretty unprecedented around the world, except for, some advanced countries like Canada that probably do it better.
Right. I guess my main issue was that if he didn't lose his job and he could keep up with the payments, that isn't he obligated to do so? And just because the value went down, he kind of throws his hands up and he can walk away without any real lasting harm to him. You can't buy a car off the lot and the next day find out it's not worth as much and renegotiate your loan.
Well,
you bought it at that price on that day.
So you buy a stock. And you think it's going to go up, and it starts tumbling, and you want to take your losses and dump this stock. You think that's morally wrong? I mean, you seem to look at this as fundamentally a moral thing rather than an economic thing, and what's best for the flow of commerce and risk-taking and investment. I could see an argument against this in the following way. You might say, well, look, if we allow people to walk away, people who don't do the right thing, to walk away relatively unscathed from their bad decisions. What about all the people who did do the right thing? What about you next to him? Maybe you could short sell your condo too. We don't want to encourage everybody to short sell their condo. And why shouldn't you if your neighbor's doing this? So that's a problem of moral hazard. You don't want to increase a moral hazard by causing the bad actors, rewarding the bad actors for the bad thing. I think that's tricky, but I also think we've got to think about broader commerce and not just, you guys are thinking about this in a rigidly moral way, it seems
right,
to me.
But I think what you just addressed, Ken, is the case that so many people are handing their keys over and walking away because they don't have, in their mind, that much to lose.
Well, I would say, you need to think clearly about this. What you're saying is that what he did is not fulfilling some moral obligations. And it can be that not fulfilling certain moral obligations is a rational or even a moral thing to do in some situations because you may have other moral obligations, like to your family and your children. But that doesn't separate the fact that at least prima facie, under things being equal, he has failed to fulfill his obligations.
I agree with you that we've changed the risk-reward calculation, but I don't think that's all bad. I mean, it had a bad consequence this time, but I think part of democracy is spreading risk and spreading reward and spreading responsibility. It's better for the American economy if he can be freed to spend on things that will actually produce greater economic activity rather than a declining asset that's deflating. I mean, you don't want people locked in by morality to keeping to pump money into deflating assets. That's crazy.
Yeah, remind me not to loan you any money.
On that note, Connie, thank you for joining us. I hope we've helped you, at least giving you some fodder for further thought.
Yes, I definitely have some new ways about thinking about it.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leah Weiss is our webmaster.
And special thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Dave Millar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University. The Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.